This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. WDRT has recently increased their broadcast area, and if you're a new listener, I hope you'll enjoy hearing each week at this time writings by Wisconsin biologists and naturalists from the current day and from the past. One of the many fountains of inspiration for me is Aldo Leopold's book, A Sand County Almanac, published in 1949. Leopold was our first ecologist. He looked at all the complex relationships between living things around us. He enhanced our way of learning from the world. He founded the Department of Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison in 1933, and his students went on to make their own important contributions to our state's natural heritage and our understanding of the riches we have here. Leopold died suddenly in 1948 and never saw a Sand County Almanac published. Every time I explore one branch of this tree of life in Wisconsin, I find many more to follow, and this has been a welcome and meaningful experience for me to read these various selections each Tuesday morning. Please take a look at the WDRT.org website and all the archived programs there. I have more than 40 podcasts saved, and many other of WDRT's excellent programs are there to be enjoyed at your leisure. And last but not least, I urge you to support WDRT if you can with a financial contribution. Big or small, it means a lot to everyone at the station to know that they are appreciated and supported. Just go to the website to do that too. Thank you. And now on to today's reading. Again, I'll be reading from the November chapter of A Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold. This part is called A Mighty Fortress. Every farm woodland, in addition to yielding lumber, fuel, and posts, should provide its owner a liberal education. This crop of wisdom never fails, but it is not always harvested. I here record some of the many lessons I have learned in my own woods. Soon after I bought the woods a decade ago, I realized that I had bought almost as many tree diseases as I had trees. My woodlot is riddled with all the ailments wood is heir to. I began to wish that Noah, when he loaded up the ark, had left the tree diseases behind, but it soon became clear that these same diseases made my woodlot a mighty fortress, unequaled in the whole county. My woods is headquarters for a family of coons. Few of my neighbors have any. One Sunday in November, after a new snow, I learned why. The fresh track of a coon hunter and his hound led up to a half-uprooted maple under which one of my coons had taken refuge. The frozen snarl of roots and earth was too rocky to chop and too tough to dig. The holes under the roots were too numerous to smoke out. The hunter had quit coonless because a fungus disease had weakened the roots of the maple. The tree, half tipped over by a storm, offers an impregnable fortress for coondom. Without this bomb-proof shelter, my seed stock of coons would be cleaned out by hunters each year. My woods houses a dozen rough grouse, but during periods of deep snow, my grouse shift to my neighbor's woods where there is better cover. However, I always retain as many grouse as I have oaks wind-thrown by summer storms. These summer windfalls keep their dried leaves, and during snows, each such windfall harbors a grouse. The droppings show that each grouse roosts, feeds, and loafs for the duration of the storm within the narrow confines of his leafy camouflage, safe from wind, owl, fox, and hunter. The cured oak leaves not only serve as cover, but for some curious reason are relished as food by the grouse. These oak windfalls are, of course, diseased trees. Without disease, few oaks would break off, and hence few grouse would have down tops to hide in. Diseased oaks also provide another apparently delectable grouse food, oak galls, A gall is a disease growth of new twigs that have been stung by a gall wasp while tender and succulent. In October, my grouse are often stuffed with oak galls. Each year, the wild bees load up one of my hollow oaks with combs, and each year, trespassing honey hunters harvest the honey before I do. This is partly because they are more skillful than I am in lining up the bee trees, and partly because they use nets and hence are able to work before the bees become dormant in fall. But for heart rots, there would be no hollow oaks to furnish wild bees with oaken hives. During high years of the cycle, there's a plague of rabbits in my woods. They eat the bark and twigs off almost every kind of tree or bush I'm trying to encourage, and ignore almost every kind I should like to have less of. When the rabbit hunter plants himself a grove of pines or an orchard, the rabbit somehow ceases to be a game animal and becomes a pest instead. The rabbit, despite his omnivorous appetite, is an epicure in some respects. He always prefers a hand-planted pine, maple, apple, or wahoo to a wild one. He also insists that certain salads be preconditioned before he deigns to eat them. Thus, he spurns red dogwood until it is attacked by oyster shell scale, after which the bark becomes a delicacy to be eagerly devoured by all the rabbits in the neighborhood. A flock of a dozen chickadees spends the year in my woods. In winter, when we are harvesting diseased or dead trees for our fuel wood, the ring of the axe is dinner gong for the chickadee tribe. They hang in the offing, waiting for the tree to fall, offering pert commentary on the slowness of our labor. When the tree at last is down and the wedges begin to open up its contents, the chickadees draw up their white napkins and fall too. Every slab of dead bark is to them a treasury of eggs, larvae, and cocoons. For them, every ant-tunneled heartwood bulges with milk and honey. We often stand a fresh split against a nearby tree just to see the greedy chicks mop up the ant eggs. It lightens our labor to know that they, as well as we, derive aid and comfort from the fragrant riches of newly split oak. But for diseases and insect pests, there would likely be no food in these trees, and hence no chickadees to add cheer to my woods in winter. Many other kinds of wildlife depend on tree diseases. My pileated woodpeckers chisel living pines to extract fat grubs from the diseased heartwood. My barred owls find surcease from crows and jays in the hollow heart of an old basswood. But for this diseased tree, their sundown serenade would probably be silenced. My wood ducks nest in hollow trees. Every June brings its brood of downy ducklings to my woodland slough. All squirrels depend for permanent dens on a delicately balanced equilibrium between a rotting cavity and the scar tissue with which the tree attempts to close the wound. The squirrels referee the contest by gnawing out the scar tissue when it begins unduly to shrink the amplitude of their front door. The real jewel of my disease-ridden woodlot is the prothonotary warbler. He nests in an old woodpecker hole or other small cavity in a dead snag overhanging water. The flash of his gold and blue plumage amid the dank decay of the June woods is in itself proof that dead trees are transmuted into living animals, and vice versa. When you doubt the wisdom of this arrangement, take a look at the prothonotary. And that's the end of this chapter of November, the part called A Mighty Fortress. I have neglected to read the very first part of this November chapter, If I Were the Wind. I will remedy this now. The wind that makes music in November corn is in a hurry. The stalks hum, the loose husks whisk skyward in half-playful swirls, and the wind hurries on. In the marsh, long, windy waves surge across the grassy sloughs, beat against the far willows. A tree tries to argue, bare limbs waving, but there is no detaining the wind. On the sandbar, there is only wind, and the river sliding seaward. Every wisp of grass is drawing circles on the sand. I wander over the bar to a driftwood log, where I sit and listen to the universal roar and to the tinkle of wavelets on the shore. The river is lifeless, not a duck, heron, marsh hawk, or gull, but has sought refuge from wind. Out of the clouds I hear a faint bark, as of a faraway dog. It is strange how the world cocks its ears at that sound, wondering. Soon it is louder, the honk of geese, invisible but coming on. The flock emerges from the low clouds, a tattered banner of birds, dipping and rising, blown up and blown down, blown together and blown apart, but advancing, the wind wrestling lovingly with each winnowing wing. When the flock is a blur in the far sky, I hear the last honk, sounding taps for summer. It is warm behind the driftwood now, for the wind has gone with the geese. So would I, if I were the wind. I'm reading Aldo Leopold's wonderful book, A Sand County Almanac, published in 1949. Thinking of the wind and the migrating geese, I encourage you to go see the spectacle of the thousands of recently arrived tundra swans resting and feeding on the Mississippi River. Take a beautiful drive to the Minnesota and Iowa side, Highway 26. This area is a major migration stopover site for them. They will continue their west-to-east fall migration to the Atlantic coast from the north slope of Canada and Alaska, where they bred this summer. Among them, you'll also see thousands of ducks and Canada geese and a few trumpeter swans with their still light gray young. They will remain until very cold weather freezes up the backwaters, so it's not too late to go see them. There are two observation areas south of Brownsville, easy pull-off and good platform for watching them. Be sure to take your binoculars. And here's an added treat for you, the sound of the tundra swans. They may fly right over your head, day or night, as they continue their migration to the Atlantic coast. This recording, thanks to the Cornell Macaulay Library. So here's what to listen for.